About 3 years ago, there was an issue of the Spirit Rock News or newsletter, and I was connected with the lead story or lead article, and on the cover of the Spirit Rock News was this title: Donald Rothberg, the most important of all possible spiritual topics. My mother appreciated that. And I appreciated the ambiguity. But it was related to the theme of everyday life practice, that there's something very crucial about making this practice real in our daily lives. And in this culture, it's not easy. It's hard. And it's been something that I've been reflecting on quite a bit the last 3 weeks, particularly since I've come back from 4 weeks on retreat. Shared with Sarah, also on...
Me too.
And you were on retreat also, wow. Wow.
For 2 months.
Wow.
You look familiar.
Yeah.
They snuck a bunch of teachers in there.
They snuck us in there to just to check what's.
Saw some others when I was looking through
with that guy. Anyway, so we have several of us in our group tonight did a substantial period of intensive practice, and I've been very focused, as maybe you have too, those who have just come from the retreat, on the importance of bringing that learning and that focus into daily life and the challenges of that, right? And the challenges of that. And what I wanted to do today and next time was to explore that territory and use the talks, and particularly the week in between, as a time for each person in each person's way, if you wish, to take on the commitment to bring a little more focus, energy, intensity in the ways that you see fit. And I'll talk about the wide range of ways that we can deepen daily life practice. But my hope is that this is something that you feel some energy for right now. And if not now, hopefully by the end of the talk. That'll be partly my objective, will be to motivate. I'm pretty motivated. I've been very, like I said, very excited, energized by the retreat. And this has been a theme for me for a long time. In fact, in some ways, my growing edge has not so much occurred on retreat, although there are always ways of deepening in the various ways on retreat. But the real edge has been, can I sustain levels of presence and insight that get stabilized on retreat? Can those be stabilized more and more in daily life? And that's been my growing edge for several years. Yeah. And what I hope to help us reflect on is what each of our growing edges are. Because there's no one formula. It's not like I'm going to say, do this or do that. But I'm going to give a number of different ways that that deepening can occur. And my hope is that one or two of them really resonate with you right now. And so that you can make a commitment for this week, and then we would come back and talk about it. Ideally, we would do this like for several months. And I'm actually contemplating doing a group. It probably wouldn't start before the fall or early next year. That would be dedicated to daily life practice. And maybe go over 3 or 4 months. You know, maybe meeting every 2 weeks, something like that. And would go over a number of different areas. You know. Maybe I'll say a little bit first about my retreat, and then I'll just to give some sense of what I was working with. And it's also very nice, you know, to share some of my experience. I sometimes think about coming back from retreats as a little bit like coming back from a trip, and Dharma talk can substitute for what used to be slideshows that risk boring people. You know, and I don't have slides from my retreat. I mean, we're not, the technology's not quite there. You know, here's Donald Brain, you know, 3 weeks into the retreat or something. Here are the brain waves doing their thing, right? But I wanted to share a few aspects. Generally, I was interested in very much in continuity and really having the retreat practice be there all the time at the retreat. You know? So this is something that many of you have done retreats know, that at a certain point when we get interested in continuity, this can be very true for daily life as well, when we get interested in continuity, things can accelerate. You know, this can take place on retreats. When I get interested in, particularly in the times when I don't have the support structure. You know, again, this is dependent on being fairly stable with, you know, with adequate levels of concentration, insight in the actual meditations. But then, can I bring the presence, the awareness, the kind heart to the times when I'm not meditating formally, when I'm walking around, when I'm eating, when I'm brushing my teeth? You know, and this is in retreat. This is one of the main ways that things deepen. And if one can do that in daily life, that can be one of the ways that we deepen. You know, concretely, one of the ways that I've been interested in, and you can see if this resonates for you, is finding little 5 or 10 minute periods during the day that you can do practice in. So, of course, the starting point is having a daily practice. And for some of us, that edge will clearly be moving from an irregular daily practice to a regular daily practice. And if you can bring that, get that together in the next week, that's huge, right? And I won't ask for a show of hands to, about these matters, but you know, one foundation of our practice is to have that daily practice for whatever period of time. It's good to have at least 20 or 30 minutes. And we can listen for ways to deepen. I'll mention a few of them. And then I'll talk about my retreat. One way to deepen is to, again, have that daily practice be regular. Another might be to increase the amount of time, maybe from 20 to 30 minutes. Another way might be if you feel drawn. This is, again, has to come, every deepening has to come organically from your own heart and your own kind of organic unfolding. Not because I said so or you think it's a good idea. It's not going to work if that's the motivation. It really has to come from some part of your being saying, yes, I want to take that next step. Always has to work like that, right? So again, my aim here is to name a number of ways to deepen and see what resonates for you. And beware if you say all of the above. That's not going to work. Be nice if it would, but generally you have to take one or two for a week. Now, over, if we were doing 4 months, all the above might have some chance of getting developed. But for 1 week, really just to see one or two things. So another way might be to say, let me find, if I have a daily sitting, to find a second sitting. Maybe I do one in the evening. Maybe it's shorter, 10 or 15 minutes. The way that I was starting to go into is something that's been actually quite important for me. It's to find a number of 5 or 10 minute periods where one can bring practice in a more organic way. So I'll give you some examples from my own experience. I do some knee exercises. I've done them for a number of years that don't involve a whole lot of demands on my intelligence. Meaning I just push a bit more or less. And it takes about 10 minutes. And at a certain point, a light went on and said, this could be a time for practice. You know, we have, you know, in the course of our training, we have many brilliant insights into the fairly obvious. It's a sign of progress. And so every day, more or less, I have that 10 minutes. It always occurs after breakfast. And for these little 5 or 10 minute periods, doing them in a regular, somewhat ritualistic way makes it work. You know? So I have 10 minutes or so, and I just do, it's another period of practice. Yeah. Another thing that I have done for some time is I typically take up one meal a day if I'm not eating with someone for that meal, and I do metta practice during that meal. Yeah. So that's an option as well. I also do one-on-one counseling with people, typically 4 or 5 afternoons a week for 2 or 3 people. And we always sit for 10 minutes. I kind of bring it into that kind of work. And I've actually, had some people who've worked with me who are therapists, and they've started doing that too. And they get their practice sessions sort of organically into their day, right? And so you can see that already I've got maybe 5 10-minute periods in addition to sitting maybe once or twice or something like that. So you can see that helps, right? So see if you can find something like that. Could be taking a walk after a meal. Could be listening to a recording. You know, maybe a guided meditation could be very helpful. Anyway, so I came into the retreat very interested in, deepening in daily life practice. And I actually organized some things to help. For example, I knew that I needed to have a colonoscopy, and I scheduled it for the middle of the retreat. I don't know if you noticed that I was gone. Probably not, but... and so I actually had a little rehearsal of going home, which was very, very helpful. And I went to Kaiser in Oakland and had the colonoscopy, and I was able to maintain really full awareness during the entire procedure, even though they told me I was sedated. I think I wasn't hallucinating being aware. But it was, it's interesting. So you can give yourself these little tests, to let me work to develop that practice. And I'll say, I wasn't going to talk so much about the formal practices that I was doing. I was working with different kinds of practices that were a lot really working with certain kinds of practices that I sometimes call awakened awareness or pure awareness, and stabilizing those further throughout the day. And also working quite a bit with the theme of emptiness, which is again a confusing term, but it really means seeing. It depends on the mind getting very quiet and being able to see into the constructed nature of experience moment to moment. Maybe one of these times I can actually focus on that theme. It's more intermediate or advanced practice. And Guy Armstrong just came out with a book on that topic, as some of you know. But it's really seeing increasingly moment to moment into the constructed nature of experience, which is powerful. It's appreciating how much our world is really organized by language and concepts, and that when one goes to a non-conceptual level of experience, it's different. There's more of a sense of everything is more like energy, not so conceptually organized. And so that was part of the retreat as well. And so coming home, I had a very, very deep motivation to practice, have this continue, the energy of the retreat continue with my daily life. It's been about 3 weeks, and still the retreat feels very strong. I was able, most of the time, I've actually kept with the same retreat structure in my daily life. So I've more or less woken up at the same time. I've simplified, One of the things that occurs on virtually every retreat that I've done is that I have the insight, I'm too busy, I'm doing too much, and it'd be great to simplify. And living with simplicity can bring so much joy. So I decided I'll just work half as much. Right. Easier said than done, right? Does that mean half the time is at Marin Sangha?
No. Okay, twice the time at Marin Sangha, because it'll be leading to emptiness.
Okay, so once one gets to a really mature place, none of this is relevant. But on the way, we have to look at this. So, but it actually was, I had a lot of insights, and especially coming home, and I came to a conclusion that I basically take in too much information. And a lot of what I'm going to name now, I think, is close to universal, right? Where it's there for a lot of us. And I talk with a certain number of people who are retired, and they say, I thought it would be different. It sure feels busy. There's a lot of doing. I don't know if that was that way for any of you who are retired, but I've heard that from a lot of people. It's I think it points more towards there being a kind of social conditioning around doing, around information. Especially, there's so much I need to know the latest about this or that. I made a commitment, really, to take in about one-third of the level of information. I've stayed with that. And again, all of these, I think, are ways of deepening practice, because when you think about taking in information, it's not so much that the information is bad, right? It's really about prioritizing. And again, one of the deep lessons of retreats or any period of doing a lot of practice is questioning one's priorities and asking, how much do I prioritize awakening? How much do I prioritize my own development and growth? And it's very easy to get caught up, be busy, get really caught in this or that. And it's challenging. Again, the sense of prioritizing, again, has to come from within. Not so much, oh, I should do this, but it has to, we really have to touch our genuine motivation. That's an important point for everything that I'm talking about now. Again, I'm mentioning a lot of different things, and my hope is that one or two of these resonate. That's the idea. I'm giving kind of a broad picture. And so that sense of prioritizing is important, because I take in more information. Again, good quality for me, being interested in socially engaged practice, and it's important to kind of know what's happening in the world, right? But the question is, how much? How much, and how much to really be adequately informed? And it's a personal decision. Personally, I said one-third of the information. I found a lot of it came from you know, actually limiting, and this is what I've done since I've come back, limiting, you know, like I generally look at the New York Times website every day. I don't know, maybe some of you do too. And I usually, you know, I said twice for 10 minutes is enough. You know, don't have to go back constantly. There's something that's addictive about electronic devices, information, and so forth. We know that, right? There's a, you know, there's a book that came out by a psychologist, social psychologist named Adam Alter called Hooked, where he looks at the kind of the psychology of what's happening on a massive scale with electronic devices. And he says that, he points to the fact that the brain state of teenage boys doing video games is exactly the same as that of a substance abuser. So the brains, basically, I think, filled up with dopamine and so forth. And I don't think it's just teenage boys with videos, right? And so we want to look at that, but it's really a question of what are my priorities? You know, there've been, we see this if you read the ancient texts, there always are calls. What do you really want? You know, time is passing. I thought I'd read two passages from some ancient texts. This is from about 1,000 years ago in Tibet. Okay. Years keep blending into months. Months keep blending into days. The exact time of reaching death cannot be planned. The exact time of death is uncertain. The place of death is uncertain. The conditions of death are uncertain. The only thing that remains certain is that you will die. Then you will not hold on to anything or any other person whatsoever. Your time is of death is unpredictable. Ah, how awful. Okay, and this is from also from Tibetan tradition a little bit later. This is from the late 19th century. Nowadays, when the five kinds of degeneration are on the rise, due to the uncouth nature of sentient beings and their powerful negative karma, every one of them clings to this life, which is no more than an episode in a dream, makes long-term plans for living indefinitely, and shows no concern for meaningful pursuits. Therefore, those who strive for the states of liberation appear no more often than stars in the daytime. And the author, this is Dujom Lingpa, goes on to say, for those stars in the daytime, I have written this book. You know? And so it's really this question of prioritizing. What do I want? What's important for me? You know? And it's something that I find with people I work with, that when people get involved, particularly if they're really devoting reflective energy towards practice, there are questions that come up, sometimes hard. How am I organizing my life? What do I want? You know? And these, you know, I've been practicing for 40 years, these questions keep coming up, right? Again, there, I think we can trust the kind of organic unfolding, and all we need to do is look for the next step or two. Again, that's all I'm aiming for here. But for me, you know, again, taking in information, I don't need to take in so much information. I can, and I find that actually having a little bit of structure is helpful. I will take in less information. For me, I've listened to KPFA a whole lot. Amazing station. How much information do I need? You know, a lot of it very good quality. But is it, what's the balance between taking in information and developing in one's own wisdom? Not easy questions, right? How do you prioritize? Is there something that's getting in the way of your practice? Is there something to let go of? What is that? You know? Is there one thing to let go of, or are there two things to let go of? And so there are many, many ways of deepening our practice. One way might be to deepen some in terms of the formal practice. We can deepen by developing better concentration. We can focus on more skill in the actual meditation, developing, having a little more focus. You know, I think that this again can be helped by guidance, you know, from teachers or friends or peers, that I think there are tendencies sometimes that one's meditation, if I meditate 20 or 30 minutes, that I'm kind of in a calm and peaceful place, but sometimes it may be actually not very much awareness or not so much concentration. And so for a lot of us, the deepening can occur by actually using our formal meditation a little more efficiently or a little more fruitfully. That's one way of deepening. And our practice, I think, is so vast that we can really deepen in any of a number of ways. You know, I was thinking that even, you know, there are ways, I think, in which our practice in our time is leading to a map of practice that's different from the map of the time of the Buddha. There are elements of our practice which I think are informed by kind of the confluence of Buddhist practice or spiritual traditions generally and the resources of the contemporary world. And I think of that in two main areas. One of them is the connection of psychology and our practice. That for a lot of us, the deepening of our practice may be related to areas of psychological inquiry, working out some of the residual patterns that are there, you know, that are still there. I work with people, as you know, a lot with the question of the judgmental mind, very, very strong in this culture. And for me at a certain point, that was very crucial practice, you know. I didn't just start teaching on transforming the judgmental mind because I thought it was a neat topic. If you get my drift. You know, it was because it came out of my own internal work, and I had some very good guides, and for whatever reason it felt like I had a kind of map that I didn't see others teaching, right? And so there are all these areas of development that might be related to our growing edge, more psychological work, connecting that with meditation, judgmental mind, working with patterns that maybe of judgment or shame or relational issues. All of these are really important to work with. And there's a very beautiful way that we're having a larger map that includes the integration of psychological and spiritual practice, and similarly with social issues, you know, as I've talked about here from time to time, that having a sense of one's engagement in the world as a fundamental area of one's practice really expands the vision quite a bit. And it's still very much being developed. You know, how can I respond to what calls me? It might be for each person one or two core issues. How can I respond to the needs of the world? And how can I connect that with my practice? That might be the edge for us. Or it might be connecting that with, you know, connecting the social dimension with one's work. Again, it can take many, many forms. It could be, again, that of, maybe I'm a yoga teacher, and I really look at the conditioning about bodies and look at how their social conditioning related to bodies, which comes up when you work with the body. It could be something like that. Or as a Qigong teacher, that might be how I deal with it, how I really bring that out. So there's a sense of practice is very vast. We have, again, we could develop in concentration or insight, quite a few people I work with find the heart practices, particularly metta and compassion, as a very compelling way to deepen in daily life. You know, I have several people I work with who actually have metta going a good part of the day. It's pretty inspiring, right? You know, one person I'd say, can you quantify? I say, yeah, maybe 30-40% of the day I have metta practice going. Can you imagine how that helps, right? And it, because metta practice, when you get into it, it's actually pretty doable. So, you know, or, you know, if you're in a helping profession, that could be possible to bring that practice in. Several people do metta practice when they're driving. You know, do forgiveness practice when you're driving. For people who that's one of my main practices. Forgiveness practice is done, in addition to people I'm close to. Forgiveness practice is often done in driving. People who cut me off, or maybe I do something that's not quite right, which of course happens very infrequently, but occasionally. So, you know. And the other main area of forgiveness practice is phone solicitations. You know, marketers, right? It's very, very important area of practice. So anyway, these are ways that one can bring the practice into daily life. It's really to see what's there. But there's a very vast sense of practice. And I think maybe I'll just say a few more things and then open things up. For others, it may be to take on a particular teaching. You know, we may, people have taken a teaching like impermanence. You can take impermanence and really track that in daily life. We've done that. We've studied that here some. You can really take that as a focus and just be aware of change throughout the day and look at it. You know, in some ways it seems intellectually obvious, but it actually can be a very profound practice to notice it over and over again. Or we may really give attention to ethics for a period of time. You know, and there's a way in which, like when I think of that 4-month curriculum for daily life practice, we would have segments, okay, for these 2 weeks, really focus on the ethical precepts and work with them, see how they come up. You know, look at them. We might do, you know, we might find that my practice is deepened by doing some reading, you know, doing reading before you sit, doing 15-20 minutes of reading a day. That can deepen your practice, because it's especially bringing in the wisdom dimension, may bring in inspiration, some energy, help shift priorities. You know, again, I have a number of students who, they have reading as one of their practices, in addition to sitting. Yeah. Another practice that I've mentioned a lot that makes a big difference for me is a Sabbath practice. One day a week, practice a little bit more. Yeah. I typically do Wednesdays. Partly because I teach often at Spirit Rock on Wednesdays, and then the rest of the day I stay at Spirit Rock, and I join the retreat and I practice for 6 or 7 hours more, you know. And doing that regularly, doing a Sabbath day, this is one way again of kind of going into the space and indicating priorities. And some people I work with, the Sabbath is 3 hours. The regularity makes a huge difference. If you can do it the same day of the week and do it regularly, you'll have a lot of the benefits that people have known from doing Sabbaths in other traditions, not necessarily meditating, but you know that you know the day is coming when you don't have ordinary responsibilities. Maybe you quote-unquote unplug or do things differently, get off the phone or electronics and so forth. Doing that even minimally for 3 hours regularly will make a huge difference in your practice. If that calls you. Of course, retreats make a huge difference. because you have a, you can have a sense, you have tremendous level of support in retreats, right? And you can really often have depth that can be very inspiring, you know, as well as work through stuff. You know, that happens. Maybe one or two more things. Speech practice is an amazing way to bring the practice into daily life. It's a whole area. You know, I teach on this a lot with Oren Sofer, and we're going to be doing a retreat in August, in a non-residential retreat in Berkeley, probably followed by a month or two of meetings. But if you can have your speech be connected with your practice, for many of us, all of a sudden, there are 5 or 10 hours a day of practice. Suddenly, out of nowhere, you know? And it can be a very formal practice. We teach it like that. It can be a formal practice where you know what to do with your mind, you know what to do with your intentions, and it can really work that way. Yeah, so this is a lot. So maybe I'll stop now, so we can have some time for discussion, and maybe I'll close with one poem from Mary Oliver, and one statement. Okay, so this is a beautiful poem. It's called Why I Wake Early. Hello, sun in my face. Hello, you who made the morning and spread it over the fields and into the faces of the tulips and the nodding morning glories and into the windows of even the miserable and the crotchety. Best preacher that ever was, dear star, that just happens to be where you are in the universe to keep us from ever darkness, to ease us with warm touching, to hold us in the great hands of light. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Watch now how I start the day in happiness, in kindness. It's another practice. Can I start the day? One of the things I've been doing is starting immediately when I wake up and go right into practice. It's another thing you can do. Even 10 minutes, 20 minutes, another practice. But there's an ancient Tibetan practice related to that. It's called clarify consciousness at dawn. Which is more or less means when you wake up, remember your priorities, remember what you're doing with the day. So again, a rich practice. And then the last thing is just one sentence by the great yogi named Shabkar, who lived in the 18th and 19th century. He said, "Let your life and your practice be one." Let your life and your practice be one. Thank you. We have probably 10, 12 minutes for any reflections, comments, questions? Again, maybe I should just, maybe before I go there, let me just invite a moment of reflection. First of all, how many of you would like to take next week and see if you can find your one or two edges for growth in this area? How many of you would like to do that and then come back next week? Okay, great. Reflect now for yourself. This is just for you. What are those one or two areas that you'd like to implement, commit to, just for 1 week? Thank you. And feel free to write it down if you want that, but that can help sometimes. So, any reflections or questions, comments? Yeah, right? Let's say our names.
My name is Lori, and I just was wondering, in the Sangha, if anybody is going to the prisons, because it's something I feel drawn to.
The goat goes to work in prison?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyone here?
You do.
Would you like to say anything about that? You can wait. Let's wait for the mic.
My name's Arlie, and I used to volunteer there weekly, and I just go in the community room now. But it's mostly doing more psychological based work and less meditation. But I'd be happy to talk to you. There's tons of programs.
Okay. It's a powerful area. Am I?
I can't understand anything.
There's a teacher named Jacques Bourdon.
Oh yeah, I've heard of him. Yeah, what?
He works. He works. He has a.
Let's use the mic. Why don't you just say it's for everyone else?
But he's come to our Sangha. He comes almost every year. Jacques Verdun.
Jacques Verdun, V-E-R-D-U-N.
Oh my God, so yeah. He it's Inside Out. It's a website, and they do wonderful work with the prisoners. And we've had some of the gentlemen come here at our Sangha, and it's been tremendously moving. How the practices he teaches it there has enabled them to go back into life.
Yeah.
And do it skillfully. So very worthy.
Yeah, and there's my colleague Kazu Haga, with whom I taught the I teach on Buddhist practice and nonviolence. He goes several times a week into the prisons, and his project is connected with the East Point Academy. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to, he does nonviolence training in prisons, so, which is powerful, you know, because they go into the roots of violence, among other things, which is powerful in that community. Please, yeah.
I just received an invitation to go on a 7-day. Desert wilderness experience with a group of people.
Yeah.
It will be led by a couple. And apparently each day will involve some meditation and some time on the land.
Yeah.
And some dialogue.
Yeah.
So I really thought about that. This might be vision quests or things I've done in the past, and it's been quite a while. So
yeah.
It would be very equivalent in many ways to a Buddhist retreat.
Very much, yeah. And it can be continuous, you know. I mean, Mark Coleman and other people teach wilderness retreats. Susie Harrington. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm pointing to is just ways that we can touch our own sense of inspiration. You know, like, because there's, this intention to awaken is, there's nothing more profound than it. I mean, it has all these different expressions, you know. Sometimes it's more inner, sometimes it's more outer. But it's, it's the same thing as deepening in wisdom and love and compassion, right? Please, Sarah, my retreat buddy.
Right. And two practices. First is gratitude.
Yeah.
That was when I was first introduced to Buddhism, and they talked about dana. What I got most profoundly was how many things in my life were priceless.
Yeah.
It's never gone away, and I have very regular, just flip into, thank you for the stars, thank you for the sun, thank you for the day, thank you for the rain,
yeah,
thank you for friends. And the other is a sentence that actually Adrian Ross said,
yeah,
that has had a profound impact on me, and that is this sentence: may you know your own goodness. For some reason, that again just tweaked me hugely. And now when I'm walking, driving, being anywhere, what I do in establishing eye contact with anyone is say, may you know your own goodness.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. That's great. That's great, Sarah. And it really points to something more general, that we may each have something that resonates, and it can be really helpful just to repeat that continually, you know, during the day. It's really a way of coming back to center, you know. May you know your goodness. May I know my goodness. Or it might be present, just to say to oneself over and over again. There might be words or sentences or a line from a poem or a line from a text that repeated over and over again bring you out of distraction, help set priorities. Yeah.
I got something.
Yeah, please.
My name is Lori, and I've been living really simply for 4 years. Got a long time without any electronics. I have a laptop, but also moving to Marin, I just don't really have any furniture since November. I've just been living a really simple life. And since the retreat, continuing that. And it's not easy when you're in it, the things the culture tells you and what you tell yourself, I've come up against depression and anxiety. It was there anyway, and it's there, and it's not easy. But what I've also found through this renunciation is this connection with wisdom that truly lets me know that I really am falling in love with myself. And enabling me to have freedom.
Thank you, Lori.
You're welcome.
And, you know, so that's, again, this could be another aspect of practice which resonates, which, you know, that, again, it's a very strong impression from anyone who has been on retreat or maybe done that wilderness work, the joy of simplicity, right? And one thing that I didn't mention also is that I and probably many or most of us, whether in just regular meditation or certainly in retreats, I can see the massive amount of social conditioning about a few issues. I think there's one about information. There's something about doing. You know, we are a culture of doers. You know, it's like I often have joked that we would prefer to complete our to-do lists over being enlightened. if people were really honest. Or another way of saying that is, you know, we get preoccupied about doing, and this is something one can see in the depths of a longer retreat, or even a short retreat, or just a 20-minute meditation, right? You can see, oh, the day's calling me. Okay, I have 20 minutes. 20 minutes. Oh, my mind is actually, you know, I'm not concentrated. I should just give up the 20 minutes because I have so much to do. Anyone relate to that? Right? You know, it's not happening. No, I should stop. I've got too much to do. And therefore you use your meditation to plan what you're going to do. You do the full 20 minutes, but you do your planning session. And the doing is so strong. Can really, I could feel that, you know, in 4 weeks, you know, it's still there. And one of the most, in a way, humorous, but also a little bit sad, is that I could feel myself at moments in the retreat. You know, this is a 4 week retreat. There's really nothing to do other than be present. I could feel myself sometimes rushing to get this done or do this or get to the next thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to watch that conditioning there, be there. You know, when it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have, in everyday life it seems to have its logic. Oh yeah, if I rush, I'll actually be more efficient, or I'll get this done, or I'll make sure that happens, or whatever. In a retreat, it makes zero sense at all, and it's just really crazy. Very interesting to observe that, you know, the moments of rushing. Okay, maybe I'll just take one more, please, and then we'll go to our metta cards and our metta at the end.
I have a friend who does something called awakening circles once a week.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Buddhist oriented, but it's an hour of meditation. And I find it so incredibly grounding to sit an hour. I never sit an hour on my own. I mean, 30 minutes is long for me. Usually my daily sits 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But once a week to sit for an hour is huge. I also memorize the Metta Sutta in English, and I memorize the 32 body parts because that really spoke to me when I learned about it.
Oh, yeah.
And so I tend to quiet my mind by reciting in my head either the Metta Sutra or the 32 body parts. And it really grounds me.
That's beautiful.
Because I notice when I sit down, my mind's bouncing to the future. And I bring it back with just reciting one of those. And it helps me be present.
That's great. Yeah. Having something like that is a tremendous resource. Because, you know, if I'm frazzled, we need ways in those situations to really... come out of distraction, come out of preoccupation, come out of the mind just getting in a stuck place. And a lot of tools there. I mean, again, this could be one focus. Let me really dedicate for the next week. I'm gonna, when I get a little bit stuck, I'm gonna try to come out as soon as possible. You know, and I have a set of intentions which takes about 2 minutes to repeat, which I've sometimes repeated here. It starts with, I intend to awaken for the benefit of others. And then I go into gratitude. And then I say, may I find peace and serenity in, you know, in what occurs. May demons and dragons become allies and helpers. Which is a good one. There, it goes on like that. And if I'm ever in a place where I'm a little bit stuck, you know, I use this particularly like in the middle of the night if I'm a little bit... If I ever get preoccupied by something, I just repeat it, and it calms, just I think like you're doing the Metta Sutta. So again, these are probably given 50 different tools, right, today. So just to find the one or two that are right for you for this next week.